watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The environment is undergoing life-threatening cataclysmic changes as a result of human activity. Suitable environmentally sustainable technologies that would preserve and provide the necessities of life have existed for decades. Why aren't they being used? Why aren't political leaders responding appropriately to solving the problems? Corporations produce and distribute products and services, but that is not their real purpose. Their purpose is to provide a financial return to their stockholders. Their products are merely a means to what they hope will be a profitable outcome. And they will change their products and services only in ways that increase profits. If they don't, they will go bankrupt. Corporate interests increasingly dominate the political sphere and thus have deformed social policymaking to benefit their bottom line. The market economy, by virtue of its structure, rewards scarcity rather than abundance. The scarcer a commodity, the more others will pay you to have it. Put bluntly, misery, want, and disaster creates a good business climate for those who control what the rest of us need. As we'll hear tonight, markets can't solve our environmental problems because they are the primary culprits. Rather than working to restore abundance, political and corporate leaders are scrambling to corner the market on precious life-sustaining resources and using law and war to do so. In the first hour, we'll hear from two scientists who will discuss the threat to the food supply, health, and environment posed by policies designed to promote the expansion of corporate power. In our second hour, a new edition of Wizards of Money linking the creation of money with the destruction of the planet's water cycle.
And I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
Our first speaker is Jonathan King, a professor of molecular biology at MIT, who has frequently written on biomedical ethics, scientific integrity, and social policy. He spoke last month about the threats that trade treaties, life patents, and genetic engineering pose to our food supply as part of a conference called Globalization and Resistance, which was held at the CUNY Grad Center in New York City.
You remember some years ago, the publicity around Dolly, the cloned sheep. Well, that group didn't publish the paper until the institute who financed the work had filed patents in the British system, not just on the cloning of sheep, but the cloning of mammals, just in general, sheep, pig, cows, etc., etc. Now, they'll be challenged. And until just recently, when the Indian government managed to overturn it, a little company in Texas, Rice Tech Corporation, was granted a patent on the basmati rice grown that had been developed over 20,000 years in Pakistan and India. Of course, the Indians and Pakistanis who developed this rice hadn't patented it. It was handed down from generations. And the Rice Tech people observed that it had never been patented in the Indian system, so they filed the patent on. They were granted it. Finally, the Indian government was forced to contest it and just... About 6 months ago, the patent was narrowed, but that's going on. All right, so this is a new kind of privatization of organisms and their progeny, and what I want to describe to you is a new class of dangers that it poses to the world food supply. Now, it poses dangers to the ecosystem, it poses dangers to health, but I want to talk about the food supply. And I want to talk about the food supply because when you're a visitor and you come into New York City, and you're walking down the streets late at night, right, and you see all the trash from the food and you see all the trucks, you realize, right, how totally independent life in the city is in the delivery of food from outside that you got to buy with cash, right? You don't have cash in New York City, right? You can't eat. I mean, yeah, you can go to a food kitchen, but it's not like you can go pull some. It's not like the Dominican Republic where there are still a banana trees, there are still a orange trees, there's still a coconut trees, and very poor people go scavenge at night, and they don't starve to death. They're poor, but they don't starve. Right? A place like New York or Chicago or Boston, right? You don't have cash. You don't eat. And though in one sense we're very aware of issues of hunger, Stanley talked about it in the plenary. On the other hand, all our lives, probably no one in this room has ever not been able to afford a cup of coffee or a glass of milk. It's just always been there, right? Even the milk prices that may have gone up, it's still true that it was a quarter 50 years ago, and now it's a buck and a quarter. It's not that bad. And they have a plan around that, the Monsantos of the world, and that's what I'm going to come to. Let's just go back a little bit to agriculture historically, 10,000 years ago, development of domesticated agriculture. If you think about around the world, farmers own their crop, and that's it. They cannot keep their neighbor from planting corn or rice or growing chickens, right? It's not that there haven't been attempts to do that, but the fact of the matter is, all over the world, farmers own their crop, and then generally they distribute or sell it. One very interesting thing is nowhere in the world do large corporations directly own the crop in the ground. They looked into this in England in the 1840s and 1850s. A sector of British capital decided to expand by getting direct ownership of the crop itself. And what they discovered was it was very uncertain. A drought would come, and they'd get hit very hard, or there'd be an insect infestation. Or they'd start trying to drive up the price of corn, as they did in England or some other thing. And then farmers, people who owned a forest, would cut down the forest and plant corn or plant grain, and they couldn't stop them from doing that. So already by about 100 years ago, the sector of British capital decides, no, you don't own the plant in the ground. You let the farmer own the crop in the ground, and you try to control the distribution. So if you look at the United States, grain distribution is controlled by a small number of corporations, Cargill, Archer Midlands, Daniel. They do not own the wheat plants. Farmers still own the wheat plants. They may not be small farmers anymore. They may be big farmers, but they don't own the wheat plant. Meat production is extraordinarily vertically integrated in the United States, with only a few large corporations controlling all the production of meat that comes out of cows, but they don't own the cows. They leave it to the farmers to own the cows, and if the cows all die for one reason or another, that's not their fault. And the classic example is is the fisheries. So Gorton, who here ever eats frozen fish from a box? What do you eat?
Hopefully nobody.
Gorton's, I don't know what they sell in New York, but they're all up there in Gloucester. And they have their processing plants right on the wharf, but they don't own the boats. And if the boat goes out and doesn't catch anything, they're insulated, right? The fisherman goes down, but if the fisherman has a good catch, they buy it. So this is true all over the world. There's been some motion around these hog plants that it gets a little bit close to the hog processes. They have such a tight lease deal with the hog farmers that it's almost like they own the hogs, but they don't. If the hogs all get sick, the bacon manufacturers, it's the farmer who loses it. All right. And the reason for that is because of this inability to control, to get an actual monopoly on the corn itself, or the cows itself, or the rice itself. All right, so just let me just remind you about a patent. A patent is a very powerful monopoly. The holder of the patent can exclude anybody and everybody from using, benefiting, doing anything with the patented product for 20 years, including a charity who wants to do it for social benefit. Patent is a very strong monopoly. The word patent does not exist in the United States Constitution because the American Revolution, one of the things that drove it was throwing off the economic monopolies from Britain. And the framers of the Constitution weren't going to touch that word, patents. What they said is that the Congress shall have the right to make laws so that artists and creative people should have the benefit of their work and basically won't starve to death, because in those days there weren't publishing houses and corporations, and if you're an inventor, you had to do it individually. Jefferson was a plant breeder. He knew all about commerce and plants, the tulip markets in Holland and Holstein cows. It wasn't that the people weren't making money off of animals and animal breeding, right? But when he oversaw the writing of the patent laws. They excluded living organisms from the patent laws for a number of reasons. One, because they believed that when you developed a better strain of tulip, that wasn't really an invention, right? That you're kind of discovering traits. And secondly, it was just too important. Food supply was too important to be allowed under monopoly control. And Jefferson actually wrote to Adams. He said, this is a noxious thing that we got to allow these patents. But whenever the damage to the society is greater than the benefit, the social benefit holds sway. These patents are a necessary limited evil. You want to limit it. So that holds till about the 1930s, and then in the 1930s you get the industrialization of agriculture in the American Midwest, development of hybrid corn, the growth of seed companies, and they want to get monopoly control over their product, right? They don't want some other company to be able to sell the farmers the seed. And so they start lobbying Congress to get patent-like protection on things like hybrid corn and ornamental roses and a variety of and things that plant breeders breed and develop. And that was opposed by consumers and it was opposed by farmers. And the compromise was the passage in 1930 of something called the Plant Variety Protection Act, which is a separate law from the patent law, which gives a kind of copyright protection to a breeder. So if you bred a beautiful hue of apricot-colored rose, other people selling that rose had to keep your name on it. They couldn't relabel it, things like that. It's copyright protection rather than patent protection. And then in the 1970s, the breeders made another effort, and they were pushed back. They strengthened that law, but they weren't able to get patent law. And then the watershed is 1980, Diamond versus Chakrabarty. One of the oil companies applies for a patent on a genetically engineered microorganism, Pseudomonas. It's a soil microorganism that they claimed degraded oil. It didn't. That was part of the PR. The patent was granted on the genetically modified organism. And since then, from that time on, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, an administrative arm of the government, completely anti-democratic. Citizens have no standing. You can't participate in their proceedings. There's patent courts. Citizens can't participate in the patent court. You can't put a friend of the amicus kind of brief in, friend of the court. You're just excluded. You have to be directly involved in the patent battle itself. They began extending the patent rights, first organisms, then Harvard Medical School got a patent on a genetically modified mouse, a whole organism, then altered genes, and now you can get a patent on just those genes that have evolved over hundreds of millions of years in organisms because you determined the sequence. The Congress hasn't touched this with a 10-foot pole. It's outrageous, right? Our genes were not invented by the Celera Corporation. I know I got mine from my mom and my dad. And if my dad isn't who I think it was, then it was some other dad, right? And those genes came down from the previous generations, and they were not invented by the people who determined their sequence, just like beryllium was not invented by the discoverer, it was discovered. Nonetheless, it's a very powerful lobby, and it's now worldwide, and they've been able to, by keeping it out of a public debate, right, by not allowing it to come to Congress, concerned citizens can't do anything on this. It's not on the agenda of the existing political parties. It's not in the political arena. It's in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and you have no standing there, so you're totally disenfranchised. Now, the Monsantos of the world, what have they done with it? So they modify, they take the major world's major food plants, let's say corn or soybeans, and they modify it genetically, insert some foreign genes, whether for good or ill, and now that allows them to apply for a patent, and they've been granted the patent. So let's talk for a little bit about Roundup Ready soybeans. Roundup is this herbicide that millions of pounds, I have the actual number, it's the actual number, 500 million pounds a year are spread over U.S. fields to kill, quote, weeds. I'm not sure how potent is a carcinogen is. It's pretty nasty stuff. But it is true that this is stuff that's not an insecticide. It's really designed to kill plants. And let's come back to that. It is nasty stuff if you're a plant. And, of course, at high enough concentration, it kills the soybeans itself. So if year after year the farmers have been applying Roundup to the fields, at some point the soybeans themselves are having trouble. Right, and the farmers are tied into this whole industrialized economy. So now Monsanto offers them Roundup Ready soybeans. You don't have to worry if your fields are poisoned by excessive delivery of Roundup. These plants will continue to grow. And so they have a big marketing campaign, and farmers buy this seed because in the United States, though farmers keep some of the seed from the current year planting, they traditionally buy seed. There are many things that you could make at home you traditionally buy, right? You know, my kids, the notion of making a pancake by mixing flour and milk and eggs and water, they never, you know, that's kind of old-fashioned to get these frozen waffles. You know, that's how you do pancakes. You don't make them by mixing them up, right? And they've seen enough advertisements about those pancakes that the notion of making pancakes seems some kind of the illegitimate kind of pancake if it doesn't come out of a frozen box. And that's the case with U.S. farmers. Not farmers elsewhere in the world, but U.S. farmers. Now, when you buy the Roundup Ready soybeans from Monsanto, you sign a contract that says, well, you understand that they own the seeds from that plant are not yours. They own the seeds. So what farmers have done for 10,000 years in general in the world, and what they do most places in the world, that they plant the crop, some of it they eat, some of it they feed the animal, and some of the seed they save to plant next year, right? Now, with Roundup Ready soybeans, you can't do this. Now, it's not that some farmers haven't tried to do that, and Monsanto has hundreds of suits, or they send the farmer a letter saying, you violated the thing, and there are a number of court cases. How do they find out that the farmers violate? They have to employ industrial spies, you know, detectives to go around. So what's their plan? Their plan is to slowly create a situation where there isn't any other soybean around than Monsanto's soybeans. And I don't have enough time, but the seed companies have a insidious campaign, and it's gone very far in Europe, that makes it illegal for a farmer to plant, quote, a non-registered variety. So they want to get monopoly control over corn themselves. So they have to stop you from just growing your grandfather's corn. So in Europe, they have rules say, well, you can't just go out and plant anything. Has to be registered. It costs money to register it. You have to maintain a registration. And they've taken to court European farmers, you know, who are growing cucumbers and potatoes and things like that, just the ones that they've always grown. So there's two components of it. You try to make it hard to find the naturally occurring varieties. You make it very easy to find the genetically engineered varieties. And then you create some situation where a farmer believes that it's a danger to go with the normal ones. So the boll weevil resistant cotton here in New York, you can't even buy farm magazines. They're not even the sophisticated places that have magazines all from all over the world don't have farmers' magazines. But if you were in the Midwest and you went to the library, you'd see Prairie Farmer. Or you just went to people's houses, they'd have Prairie Farmer. And in Prairie Farmer, you'd be loaded with these full-page ads about don't take a chance on the corn borer or the boll weevil wiping out your crop this year. You want your kids to be able to go to college, don't take a chance on that. And how are you going to avoid that? You're going to buy their boll weevil or corn borer resistant strains. And I used to live out there, and I it's very compelling. If you're really surrounded by this world, it says you got to watch out for those corn borers, you got to watch out for those boll weevils, they might come back, so and so. You know, we got this resistant seed. It's hard not to go in that direction, because if a farmer does lose one year's crop, they're in big trouble. Now, what happens if they succeed? Well, the best example is the 1973 oil, quote, oil crisis, right? The oil industry, oil, you can buy gas for, I don't know what it was in those days, 35 cents a gallon, right? And they create a little oil shortage, you know, have a little war. And I forget how it was actually done there in 73, but or claim that OPEC is embargoing oil or something like that. Oil prices go. You have all kinds of articles about there's a shortage of oil in the world. The U.S. going to run out of oil. You know, Scientific American and NPR. And Cooney was just loaded with all these seminars about how, you know, we're having an energy crisis. The oil costs shoot up, right? You know, goes to from a quarter a gallon to a dollar a gallon. A year or two later, it turns out that there is no oil crisis. The world is awash in oil, but the prices don't go down. They go down a little bit, so you create a shortage that allows prices to go up. So I'm just going to close with this is going on with every crop that you can imagine. If you eat it, cantaloupe, right? There's active research programs to generate some genetically modified cantaloupe that you can convince some cantaloupe farmer that's a better thing to plant in order to create a situation where those cantaloupes replace the natural cantaloupes, and therefore at some point the price of it can be raised. Now, when the price is raised to the farmer, it's going to be raised to the consumer, right? At the point that some very large fraction of corn farmers are buying Monsanto's genetically engineered corn, all they have to announce is a little, oh, there's been some problem and there's a shortage, right? There's a shortage of this genetically engineered seed. Oh, there's going to be a shortage in the corn supply this year in the United States. And then all of a sudden, corn flour and pancakes and bread, and, you know, price of all kinds of things kind of go up. Now, in the third world, it's much more direct. So Rice Tech tried immediately to get Indian and Pakistani rice farmers to buy licenses from them to put basmati on the rice. And they just were unable to do that. Hundreds of thousands, there were these demonstrations in India. Vandana Shiva was actually here some years ago describing this. But in many countries, that's not the case. Indigenous farmers, small farmers are not organized, and they're not able to resist you know, these kind of corporate incursion. Now, the World Trade Organization, the natural thing that happens in these countries in Brazil is the farmers say, what do you mean you own these seeds? How could you own these seeds? You know, this plant has been in human society for thousands of years. So they have to be able to enforce it, right? They have to be able to put such a farmer in jail or somehow silence them, which requires that the domestic laws support these international patent laws. So one of the main thrusts of the World Trade Organization, and this, the U.S. working through it, has been to extend U.S.-style strong patent monopoly protection into all the countries of the world through the TRIPS, trade-related intellectual property rights. The U.S. was able to get that incorporated into WTO over the resistance from all the African countries and many Asian and South American countries. And what the TRIPS says, you have to enforce these plant patents in your country, and if you don't do it, there's going to be sanctions against you through the World Trade Organization. We just had a counter victory. It's in today's Times. At this latest round in Qatar, the AIDS crisis, right, and the same thing the patents used to keep prices on AIDS drugs super high to ensure super profits in the industry, have been weakened by the country's voting that, well, if there's a health crisis in the country, we can break the patent or override the patent. But that's just on drugs. Right, and doesn't touch these plant patents and agricultural patents. Why don't I?
You have about 5 more minutes if you want.
Okay. Then let me just touch briefly on the health aspects of it. The genetic modification of the food is done in the name of nutrition. Some of you may have seen the ads about the yellow rice. It's totally fraudulent. I mean, you'd have to eat 15 pounds a day of that rice to get things. And, you know, and that vitamin is in conventional brown rice. It's just if you hold the rice, you lose the B vitamins. I mean, if you're worried about a vitamin shortage in rice, just have people eat brown rice. I mean, it's not any big deal. But so all this genetic modification is done in order to get the patent. And therefore, all the kind of testing that you might assume is being done, well, gee, if it's genetically modified corn, well, babies eat a lot of corn products. Shouldn't we test? Shouldn't we have extensive tests on young people, old people? There's none of that. Zip. Because it's not about increasing the nutritional content of the grain. It has to do with this getting the patent and the marketing. So there's millions of species of plants in the world. There's only about 36 over since the evolution of Homo sapiens that it's turned out have this special property of serving for human nutrition. And if you look at the evolution of human civilizations, it's tied to certain crops: rice, grain, maize, a few other cereals, oats, etc., cassava, in Africa, and many, many, many other plants. You go out to Central Park, let me tell you, most of those things, you might eat them, right? But you'll still starve to death, right? Because those plants do not have their molecules organized in a way that they provide human or mammalian nutrition. It's a very special thing, those food plants that are tied to human nutrition. And the evolution of human society is intimately related with the fact that grain and our digestive system and our metabolism is very tightly coupled. So I'm not saying any particular messing around with the corn or the rice is going to be problematic. But you know that one of these strains is going to have unexpected problems. Hard to predict. The natural one is food allergies. And that's already come up. You know, we know that 10% of the population gets intense reactions to certain components, for example, in nuts. And so the general social concern about people being nervous about genetically engineered food is absolutely scientifically sound. Don't let anybody tell you it's some kind of overreaction. It's absolutely sound to be concerned about these things, and their public relations programs are just straight, I don't want to say lies because they go after you for libel, but they have no basis in regulatory or testing or things like that, and they're not regulated because the Food and Drug Administration only regulates things in a bottle, not in the ground. The EPA doesn't deal with food issues. And so there is no oversight to ensure this. So that's one aspect of it that, you know, it may be years before an inadvertent health effect will come up. But given the range of plants this is being done in the absence of oversight, you know, cantaloupe and broccoli and strawberries and corn and wheat, I'd say there's no rush, right? I am a genetic engineer. My students go to work in the biotechnology industry. I do this kind of work. I believe in it. When you're talking about the human's food supply, very slowly and very carefully, and certainly not moving these experimental foods into actual commerce, right? You know, I'd say you got to go 20, 30 years before you'd even know you'd have the kind of testing base to be sure that some subgroup of the population, elderly people, kids who eat it when they're one, but you see the effects of puberty or something like that, are really sound. Given the power and the level of organization they have, and that there's no organized, no mechanism in the United States right now to there are mechanisms of resistance, but they're tough. That's one piece. And then the last piece I'll close with has to do with the genetic modification of human genes, because I believe that in the United States, the ability to have some beachhead for democratic control of this technology is going to come around the question of human genes, just because it's closer to home than raising corn or raising rice or the neem tree. Most everybody tends to have some feelings about their genes as they learn about them. And so one of the things I've been most involved in, and still hasn't taken off, but I think it's going to take off in the next couple of years, we do have a campaign which was started about 5 years ago called No Patents on Life. And of course, no patents on life means no patents on human genes, because we're part of the living system. And there, I think there's some possibility. I mean, you have to change the law, right? You have to get introduced into the Congress a bill that says we want to clarify the Patent Act. Patents, living organisms are excluded from patents. That's a very tough sell, because then you've got this powerful agrochemical biotechnology lobby. But around no patents on human genes, now the balance of forces changes a little bit. In the religious community, there's very profound feelings that genes were not created by scientists. There's very strong, you know, kind of human dignity components. Now there's some very strong lobbies of people who have genetic, who have inherited diseases, and they're all for genetic engineering as a way to, quote, cure the genetic diseases. And so they want commercialization of that technology, because that's the most rapid way to get it. So it is quite a knockdown, drag-out battle. I'm just going to close with this, the language of this petition, which was a joint effort of about 25 environmental organizations some years ago. The plants, animals, and microorganisms comprising life on Earth are part of the natural world into which we are all born. The conversion of these species, their molecules, or parts into corporate property through patent monopolies is counter to the interests of the people of this country and the world. No individual, institution, or corporation should be able to claim ownership over species or varieties of living organisms, nor should they be able to hold patents on organs, cells, genes, or proteins, whether naturally occurring, genetically altered, or otherwise modified. As part of a world movement to protect our common living heritage, we call upon the Congress of the United States to enact legislation to exclude living organisms and their component parts from the patent system. It doesn't have a chance in the world of passing. We just want to get a public debate over it. And if you have a public debate, you can organize around it. Thank you very much.
That was Jonathan King, professor of molecular biology at MIT, speaking on a panel on politics and technology at the Globalization and Resistance Conference last month in New York City. Another panelist on that topic was Jeffrey Busolini, our next speaker, who is currently working on a dissertation on the intersection between nuclear weapons research and the Human Genome Project. He addressed how corporate priorities undermine progress in areas from arms control to global warming.
I'm going to split my comments. I'm going to talk about two-thirds about an aspect of genetic modification, and I'm going to speak a third or so about global warming because, you know, I've done more on genetics, but I just came back yesterday from the Netherlands where I've been for a while and working with some organizations like Rising Tide and ACED that are very concerned about global warming. And there's somewhat of a different framing of the problem of global warming in the Netherlands like we were speaking about before because, first of all, it's outside of the United States, and so it's outside of a little bit of the warp field of the United States, you know, the capitalist warp field of the United States. Not entirely, because, of course, they have Shell there, which is, you know, part of the problem, too. But, you know, sometimes people say the Netherlands is like the Bangladesh of Europe, that if there's going to be a thermal expansion due to global warming and due to, you know, melting of polar ice or something like that, then the Netherlands stands to have a real problem the same way that countries like Bangladesh do. So there's a, you know, there's a little different kind of spin on the problem in the Netherlands. So we'll talk about that in a few minutes. First of all, I'm going to talk about an aspect of genetic modification that has unfortunately gotten a whole new spin or a whole new lease on life, so to speak, in the last couple of months. I'm going to talk about genetic modification of biological weapons because this is something that I've done a fair amount of research on, and unfortunately, like I say, it's been foregrounded in a new way recently. I should start off by saying that biological weapons, in general, are not necessarily genetically modified. There's plenty of biological weapons that, you know, can be made at various levels of crudeness or sophistication by, you know, growing things in your backyard, basically. And then there's like more and more refined laboratory techniques you could apply to them to make different kind of organisms. And then there's a whole other subset or subcomponent of biological weapons which has to do with their genetic modification to do things like reduce the susceptibility that they have to antibiotics or to try to increase the way in which they can be propagated, things like that. All right, I approach this this issue because in general, I've spent a lot of time trying to pay attention to questions about weapons and warfare and technology, about the history of weaponry, the history of the way that humans use weapons to attack one another and to kill one another and to try to further their political objectives. And especially, I look at it from a perspective that in the 20th century, we've entered a new dynamic as relates to warfare and weapons because of the fact that the technological developments that have taken place and the particular junctures of politics and technology that have arisen in the 20th century makes it so that it's not just a matter anymore of a situation where thousands or tens of thousands of people could be killed in a warfare or in conflict, which is bad enough. But, you know, the real possibility of human extinction or of mass genocide is presented by so-called weapons of mass destruction, like nuclear weapons and chemical weapons and biological weapons. So I think also further that as activists, this presents a real imperative too, because when we enter onto a terrain like this in the 20th century, at the further development of different kinds of nuclear weapons and hydrogen bombs and neutron bombs, but also different forms of nerve gas or different forms of lethal biological agents, I think it makes it so that there's a kind of an onus on being aware of what's going on and also trying to put as much pressure on possible as possible on the governments involved. You know, try to really take account of what's taking place and to try, you know, even though it may be the case, as some people in the weapons business say, that the genie won't go back in the bottle, people like Robert Oppenheimer, the so-called father of the atomic bomb, and others like Hans Bethe, maybe, who became more skeptical of atomic weapons after they had worked on them, they would say the genie won't go back in the bottle, the technology exists, it's out there. Even though that might be the case, there's a lot of things we can do to try to decrease the incentive to use weapons like this and to try to cut down on the impact. All right, also, we might just note in passing, I guess, flamboyant French sociologist or French philosopher Jean Baudrillard, who's known for writing the book America and Critique of the Political Economy of the Sign and things like that, wrote an article a couple weeks ago where he addressed September 11th, and he makes the point more or less that it might have been the terrorists who did it, but we all wanted it. And he says that we won't be able to understand the symbolic meaning and the symbolic register of the destruction of the World Trade Center, unless we are aware of this dynamic, which he thinks exists to some extent in all of us, of a kind of resentment of power. And he thinks that the more and more that U.S. power got concentrated and built up, the more that it also gave rise to a kind of a counterpower or a hatred of this power. And I think this, you know, it perhaps applies for something like the World Trade Center, but I think it certainly applies for something like the U.S. Military forces and U.S. nuclear forces or U.S. chemical weapons forces, because I think the more the United States has pursued a path of developing weapons like this, I think it undermines the U.S. credibility to try to promote peace or to try to discourage other countries from developing weapons like this. And so I think that this is an area where that kind of resentment of power is very germane. Okay, I was going to say a few things quickly about the context of Los Alamos, where I've done a lot of research looking into the history of the place and also the way that the place operates, because it helps to shed some light on these issues, and it unfortunately has some elements, some ways in which it's tied very deeply to the current situation with anthrax and other possible biological weapons. First of all, Los Alamos represents a special turning point in the history of science with the Manhattan Project, because it's a new organization to scientific endeavor, bringing a lot of scientists together, especially technologically intensive kind of science where you have to use devices like nuclear accelerators or things like that, or supercomputers for the first time, to try to tackle a big problem, which at that time was to develop the atomic bomb. And that, you know, has served as a touchstone since then for all kinds of different scientific projects where people will call for a Manhattan Project on cancer or a Manhattan Project on AIDS or something like that to try to evoke this notion of teams of scientists who are working on a specific problem, and they're all supposed to be orchestrated together or tackling different components of the problem, but all towards the same end. So it's a change in scientific organization. And it's also part of the reason why second half of the 20th century is so dangerous when it comes to weapons of mass destruction, because it happened to be the case that through the Manhattan Project and afterwards, teams of scientists, not only in the United States, but many other places in the world, were paid on an ongoing basis to develop and to refine more and more lethal and more dastardly weapons. That's the second component of Los Alamos. It's devoted to weapons. It's, you know, they do a few other things there, but pretty much it's a laboratory which is devoted to the production of weapons and devoted to imagining new weapons. Also, something that's important about it is that it's secret, and it plays into the dialogue of national security and the doctrine of clear and present danger. And a lot of kind of liminal areas in the U.S. law by which the government is able to make an end run around conventional civil liberties considerations or conventional considerations about the way that the public should be able to have access to what the government is doing. And on the one hand, there's this national security issue. And on the other hand, we have a more recent form of it, but which has the same kind of sway as an argument, which is that the secrets of industry in the United States need to be protected, because if they're not, industries in other countries are going to be able to steal the secrets and make use of them. So this is, for instance, why the United States has oftentimes stood in the way of strengthening the Biotoxic Weapons Convention enforcement protocols, because the United States says that inspections of the U.S. biotechnology industry would lead to other countries stealing the research of the United States and making use of it and putting it to market. So it's kind of this double valence of national security secrecy and economic secrecy going together. Also, last major characteristic of Los Alamos, which helps to shed light on bioweapons, is that in Los Alamos, they've really perfected this what you might call inverse defense mentality, where this research is justified under the heading of it's being for defense and mutually assured destruction. This kind of idea, but in actuality, you know, even though it's supposed to be for the defense of the United States, for the defense of the U.S. population, and providing for all of our safety, what's really happening is that there's a tremendously vibrant and out of control program for the development of offensive weapons, which is just by a sleight of hand renamed as defense. Okay. The Cold War in general and the nuclear arms race in general demonstrates this, because as each new successive generation of warheads was developed, the scientists will say, or some politicians will say, We are not trying to, you know, further the arms race with the Soviet Union. This is like, you know, say like 62 or 58 or something like that. We're not trying to, you know, make things worse. We're not trying to further the arms race with the Soviet Union. They would say we feel we're in a situation where, because we know that the Soviet Union is working on these weapons, we have to work on them because we have to try to predict what they might be doing. There's no way that we can predict or defend against what the Soviets are doing unless we do it first. And so it's this very strange backwards kind of logic, because it ends up where, you know, the United States actually would develop some kinds of weapons like the hydrogen bomb or the neutron bomb first, but all the time saying that this was somehow a defensive overture, you know, and not a development of a new weapon, which has like new capacity.
But also, there's anthrax stocks all over the United States in military labs. That's where the anthrax came from one of the U.S. anthrax supplies. Mm-hmm. Why do we have anthrax stocks? Because, well, how are we going to defend ourselves against
their anthrax?
Their anthrax, unless we're familiar with the properties of anthrax. So that's why this. Yeah, it's from Ames, Iowa. You know, is the strain comes from. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good point. And it illustrates. I mean, it's also the way that the U.S. You know, I mean, other countries do it too, but we'll talk about the U.S. by and large here. It all, you know, can make an end run also around treaty agreements too, because like treaties, even like the Biotoxin Weapons Convention, has this provision that says that if you're going to work on things, they're supposed to be defensive. They're supposed to be like prophylactic, preventive. Or what's the other one? Or peaceful? Then you're allowed to do that kind of research. But when there's this very, very fluid boundary between what's offensive and what's defensive, you can be developing new weapons, and you can say that it's a defensive overture. So it's a particular pathology of the U.S. national security mindset. All right, now. For a long time, even before these recent few months, I've been asking myself the question in researching Los Alamos, why is it that there's so much genetics research at a place like Los Alamos? This is a place that's recognized as a nuclear physics laboratory. It's recognized as a center for particle physics, for accelerator work, you know, for some branches of theoretical physics and astrophysics. But it doesn't immediately make sense why there should be such a molecular biology infrastructure there as well. I think that there's a couple reasons why that's the case. Some people will tell you that it's because that's the way the science has evolved and that's just where the funding is, and that doesn't really answer the question. It doesn't really get to the main reasons why I think it's the case. The reasons are there is certainly a crossover between molecular biology and physics, and molecular biology is probably much more closely related to physics as a discipline than it is to earlier forms of biology in terms of the laboratory techniques and in terms of the way that a lot of the research is conducted. But second of all, the main reason is weapons, weaponization applications, because they're not just interested in Los Alamos in cataloging the genome or in doing genomics. They're interested in figuring out what kind of weapons can be derived from this research. And you've probably heard about some particularly dastardly plans that they have to try to manufacture, whether or not it's possible, ethnicity-specific genetically engineered biological weapons that they think, you know, some scientists have this conjecture, you know, obviously Dr. Strangelove or someone like that, that it would be possible to, you know, and the Israelis are working on weapons like these too because they believe that it would be possible to manufacture biological weapons that could somehow only be effective against Palestinians but not affect Israelis. I mean, there's myriad problems with the way that this is, you know, set up, and but nonetheless, that there is like a
of course, the irony there is they're the same ethnic stock, right? Mm-hmm. Israelis and Palestinians are actually very closely related.
So. Find out the hard way.
Right, they haven't made very much progress.
Right. So some of this tie, some of this weaponization has been coming out a lot more in the last few months. I mean, it was barely realized before, but now it's been mentioned in several news sources that the biggest stock of genetic information, biggest database about anthrax anywhere is at Los Alamos. And it's not coincidental, it's because they've been trying to figure out what kind of weaponization applications it could be put to for a long time now. Also because it's a laboratory, like I said a second ago, that's devoted to technoscientific production of new forms of weaponry, so it's kind of like a, you know, expert expert house that's been set up for that. All right. Next point that I want to make, before also touching a little bit on that point you were just making about how likely the current forms of anthrax that are in use in the United States came from the U.S. weapons program. But before that, I want to make this point about how there's a very strong myth, which is frequently referred to and frequently represented in all kinds of media accounts and even from lefty sources, from all kinds of sources, that the United States biological weapons program was ended in 1969. And this is basically an absolute lie. There's nothing really to support it. What is frequently asserted, the story goes that in 1969, President Nixon decided that the United States should unilaterally do away with its development of biological weapons. And I think there's a simple litmus test for this. It's the same litmus test that the reason why we know that the election was rigged in Florida. The litmus test is, would Nixon ever do such a thing? Would Nixon ever unilaterally, voluntarily do away with a major research program and weapons program in the heart, during the heart of the Cold War? I think it's extremely unlikely. But for some reason, people give him the credit with being able to do it because he was so conservative, and they think that it makes sense that he would be able to do it. But overall, I think that the notion that during the Cold War, when there was well-documented knowledge that the Soviet Union had an active program to develop biological weapons, the notion that the United States would do away with its major part of its research infrastructure on biological weapons doesn't make any sense. It doesn't really account for why the U.S. has historically been so resistant to the confidence-building measures and the verification regime related to the Biotoxin Weapons Convention. Because if the United States really had nothing to hide, then the United States wouldn't necessarily be so up in arms about it. I mean, it could be accounted for to some extent by the market concerns I was just mentioning, or the biotechnology industry, but I think that also it's because fundamentally there's something else there. There's something else going on. Okay. Also, another argument that's made that goes along with this notion that Nixon supposedly did away with the biological weapons program is said that the United States feared that because of the way that it's relatively easy to produce biological weapons compared to the difficulty of producing working fission bombs or even more so fusion bombs, it was feared that by supposedly some policymakers or strategic thinkers in the United States that it would be much easier for some country that didn't necessarily have an advanced military and industrial sector to be able to start to rival the power of the U.S. by putting, a little bit of money, but maybe a lot of that country's GDP, into developing bioweapons. And so supposedly this is like an early form of fear in the U.S. strategic complex about this notion of asymmetrical warfare that has been talked about a lot in the last couple of months. So supposedly the United States feared that this is a kind of asymmetrical warfare that another country could take part in, and that it would in effect undercut the U.S. superiority in nuclear weapons and in conventional forces. But I also think that this argument doesn't make very much sense because, first of all, just because the U.S. stopped its research on biological weapons, it doesn't prevent some other country from still doing that, from still developing biological weapons to use against the United States. And so it has no real binding force. It has no on other countries. And all it would do is put the U.S. in a position where if the United States were attacked with biological weapons, it's obligated to retaliate with nuclear weapons or with chemical weapons or by some kind of massive conventional assault. Second, according to the Cold War paranoia of that time, any vulnerability or problem like that was taken very seriously, obviously, and it's not likely that they're going to give up their capacity for response in kind. Thirdly, the U.S. had substantial knowledge and a substantial research infrastructure into biological weapons, also like its research into nuclear weapons and chemical weapons. And so it doesn't exactly make sense that, if the U.S. saw itself as having a high degree of sophistication in, all kinds of weapons of mass destruction development, it doesn't make sense that they would decide arbitrarily to give up that kind of superiority in biological weapons, but not in nuclear weapons and chemical weapons. Okay. And then there's this, backwards logic issue we were just talking about, where if the United States knows that the USSR was doing it at the time, There is a very strong feeling within the defense infrastructure that, therefore, the United States has to do it too. So, these arguments are fishy at best about the U.S. bioweapons program having been eliminated. And when it comes down to it, they're just an absolute lie, because there's been a major amount of funding for both biological and chemical weapons programs, which have taken place by so-called black appropriations to places like Los Alamos Laboratory or to Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, and also, of course, at Fort Detrick, Maryland, where the Army has its biological weapons research facility. There's also extensive research of this kind there, and at a number of other laboratories, like you were making reference to, that are kind of peppered here and there around the United States. And anyway, I think that's an important element of this story of the U.S. national security regime that needs to have light shed on it, because it's a kind of pernicious lie. All right, so the current anthrax situation, just like Jonathan was saying, it seems likely that some of the strains of anthrax which have been used in the United States did come from U.S. weapons programs, but they haven't been so frank or so outright about admitting this because of the claim that these programs were done away with in 1969, and so they're between a rock and a hard place. Also, I think that they're saying that the government's handling of the anthrax problem has been shameful, because it was at least 3 weeks or a month when they knew that there was anthrax in circulation, and they didn't make any kind of announcement at all. And this also shows the paternalism of the national security state, that they think that we need to be protected from ourselves, or we might panic if someone says anthrax. And so better for anthrax to be let, to be in circulation and people not know about it until they can set up the proper PR regime or whatever. So anyway, this led now to the FBI saying it's likely one person, likely domestic. And, now I think that they're thinking that, it's perhaps like a rogue scientist or, someone who used to work in the bioweapons program and now they're part of a militia or something like that. And one hears ramblings, that the profile matches the genetic profile of this anthrax matches the genetic profile of the U.S. weapon strains, and not like the Soviet weapon strains, for instance. And this is why they were also talking about the modification of the anthrax to withstand antibiotics, because there are U.S. strains which are like that, but there's more former Soviet strains that are like that, which were genetically engineered to resist antibiotics. And so they started saying right away, this hasn't been genetically engineered to resist antibiotics. And so even though there was this conjecture that it would have been easy to buy anthrax from the former Soviet Union, what with the economic collapse, it seems like that's not the case. And there's another, it comes back to the point of why we need to be very vigilant to try to really root out problems and programs like this that exist in the United States, because it creates a danger to us directly to have, to be messing around with things like this. All right, that's it for the bioweapons part. And I'll say a few things about climate now and about global warming, because we should address that as well as part of the, under the heading of technology and in the environment. As you know, there's just a meeting concluded in Morocco a couple weeks ago called COP7. It was the latest in a string of meetings to try to address the problem of international climate change. Of course, also that the United States has been uniquely recalcitrant about this problem, not even wanting to admit that there is a problem, unilaterally crushing some of the important agreements. I mean, the Kyoto Accord is already too little too late, but if we don't even enact the Kyoto Accord, then we're really going to be in big trouble. So unfortunately, the United States is in the unique position, because since the U.S. is the major producer of greenhouse gases, like something like 55% of the global output, if the U.S. doesn't go along with some accord like this, then it severely undermines it. But nonetheless, other countries have made a decision to try to go ahead and enforce the Kyoto Protocol as much as possible, even though they know that the United States is not going to go along with it. And they're trying to diplomatically isolate the United States to put more pressure on the United States to go along with some accord like this. But so that's one kind of positive development of the last weeks, that at least people are deciding that even though the United States has shipwrecked this agreement, it doesn't have to be totally scrapped. However, there is something that's a pretty negative development to come out of COP7, which is that it seemed like a leap forward in the trend towards marketizing climate change and making climate change something which is cast as amenable to solution by economic or by market measures, instead of asking some difficult questions about economic production as a source of this problem. So there's been a lot of negotiation about trying to put a regime in place of emissions quotas, different countries and within different countries, different industries having a certain amount of pollution or greenhouse gases that they're able to emit. And then the parallel side of this coin, there's been this talk about carbon sinks and carbon credits, where countries that have forests that are supposedly a large source of oxygen and of absorption of carbon dioxide are supposed to get credit for this. So, you know, Russia, for instance, wants, and now there's a negotiations and disputes going on because they're trying to decide the standards for setting the area that a country is entitled to have for a carbon sink or for a carbon credit. Russia wants to get as much of their forest land as possible designated as carbon credit or carbon sink, but at the same time they want the price or like the unit value per acre or per square kilometer or whatever to be as high as possible. But unfortunately, because it's approached as a market problem, the more that they get in terms of area that's counted as carbon sink, the more the price is, you know, dwindles down. And then Japan, on the other hand, which is probably going to buy a lot of this credit from Russia, wants to pay the lowest price possible. So there's some haggling going on about how to set the area that's counted as carbon sink and the price, the value per area. All right, so now what's happening, and this is part of a general move of co-optation that you see that the World Bank is doing, the IMF is doing, the WTO is doing, they're co-opting the climate issue, and they're trying to represent it under the heading of something that can be positively solved or positively addressed by the market. And they're increasingly saying that the market is the way to address global warming. Instead of asking serious questions about growth and serious questions about industrial development as the source of this problem, it messes up or shipwrecks some of the possibilities for changes now in industrial production. It maintains a short-term profit focus where companies don't want to think about a medium-term or a long-term in which they're switching over to less polluting production. They want to focus on the balance sheet in the immediate, you know, short-term, and this, of course, is all aided and abetted by the global financial flows and the slavish attention to all the stock markets. It's obviously not sustainable because it's just based on short-term profit. It's not based on any kind of conception of, warming or sea level rise or, you know, harmful pollution that affects humans or anything like that. So what's required, I think, is a serious, you know, it's another agenda for activists. Required is some serious task-taking and taking to task this culture of convenience and self-interest, which is very prevalent in the United States and which keeps coming up when issues of climate are brought up. You know, George Bush will say, well, you know, gas prices could go up 50 cents a gallon, and people don't want that. You know, or heating oil prices could go up, or all of our consumer good prices could go up because the production costs are going to go up. So we're going to have to start to take to task this ethic, you know, the ethic of the market and this, this kind of rationalization that hovers around the bottom line, because that's right now aiding and abetting and going part and parcel with propagating the problem of global warming and leading to these off-key notions that the market could somehow resolve the same problem that it's at the same time creating or giving rise to.